Kia ora, everyone. I'm Emmeline Pat Dahlstrom from Spacebase, a social enterprise focused on catalyzing the space entrepreneurial ecosystem starting in New Zealand to solve challenges on Earth and beyond. You're listening to the Spacebase podcast. Today, I'm interviewing Erica Lloyd, who has a broad and varied career here in New Zealand and across Asia Pacific and the USA in broadcasting, technology, banking, and innovation businesses. Erica is a seasoned executive who started life running her own cutting-edge tech services company in film and the television sector. She's worked on both sides of the camera as an on-air business journalist for Television New Zealand and MediaWorks as a network news producer. For half a decade, she was also part of the executive management running local IT and tech giant Datacom. She's been an executive at Callahan Innovation and local generative AI leader Soul Machines, and joins me now to talk about her latest, and I hear, favorite role to date as Chief Revenue Officer for fast-scaling space tech startup, Zeno. Welcome, Erica.
Oh, thank you for that lovely introduction.
Again, thank you so much for taking the time and for agreeing to be on the Spacebase podcast. Super excited to hear about your career journey, and in particular, because it is kind of like atypical for most people who actually work in the space industry. So really, really interested in how you kind of like got to where you are. Maybe let's start from the beginning. Where were you originally from in New Zealand? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Auckland. So unlike many people who live in Auckland, I actually grew up here. For the last 15 years or so of my working life, I've spent a lot of time offshore, either virtually or traveling. Asia Pacific, and the last 3 or 4 years mostly in the US with Soul Machine.
Yeah, from the start, do you love space, or like others, was it a gradual process of discovery?
I love this question. Can I tell you, I work in space, but I love Earth. I love
same
looking,
here.
Yeah, I love looking at space, and as a child was obviously enchanted, like we all were, with the blessed with dark skies here. And, you'd look up in wonderment, and I've never lost that. But I love Earth, and I love the space sector, actually, to think more about how we can protect our Earth resources and be more thoughtful, sustainable, really, truly sustainable in the way that we access and use space. I think that's important. The other thing for me is I grew up with a love of flying and the sky. My family, my mother was, she was brought up in the Air Force, and my grandfather was in the Battle of Britain. He was in the RAF. And as a child, I was enchanted. He started the Motat aeroplane park. And on Tuesdays, him and his former colleagues, cobbers that flew together, would be repairing the Lancasters, the Mosquitoes, the old planes that they flew.
Oh, wow.
And I would go out there and sit with them and, have tea and morning tea, and while they tinkered with the aircraft. And it lit a spark in me for loving to fly, loving to be in the skies. And it's wonderful to be part of a continuum of that as well.
Oh, that's really amazing to hear. No, oh, great. And so, yeah, I'm really curious, taking you back to probably your childhood years, who or what influenced you when you were growing up?
Oh, that's a funny question. But for me, it's always been about curiosity and also trying new things. So as a young person, my desire to leave New Zealand overrode everything else. And so I went offshore really early at 18 or so and traveled for a couple of years. On return, I started a business in film post-production. So I'd worked in a laboratory and did almost like an apprenticeship, if you like, learning how to physically cut motion picture film in the days before digitization. And this was sort of a trade, really. It was a technical skill, cutting down the motion picture negative, 16 mil or 35 mil, and matching them to edited work print before they're printed and then projected in the cinemas. That skill became obsolescent quite quickly, but the business I started at age 20 with a colleague was to exploit the early digital interruption, if you like, of film post-production. So at the time, there was a process for editing films digitally, but there wasn't a way to cut the original negatives and then get them printed for release. So we kind of exploited that hack with a manual coding system, very early and very clunky, but it started as a service industry supporter and then grew to be quite a successful business. So I worked for Peter Jackson, Jane Campion, all the big filmmakers of the time,
Wow.
and we ended up with a number of, building a reasonably sized business and addressing the television market as well as TV commercials and those kind of things. And those were the sort of heady days of film production, and people would shoot these massive ratios and make these really glorious commercials and documentaries and film, the Natural History Unit films that New Zealand was famous for as well, we worked on. But what I learned really quickly was you can't be sure of anything. And that business was very successful until it wasn't, and then it dropped like a stone. The technology was disintermediated and it no longer existed. Kodak was our biggest supplier, and we all know the Kodak analogy. So the first 10 years of my working life was fairly entrepreneurial and eventful. And I decided that I wanted a bit more surety in terms of going into the production end of broadcasting.
Yeah. Before we go further, I'm just curious about, how did you get started? In terms of even like, working for a startup company, how did that even came about? For me, it feels very unusual as well, because most people would either, go to uni before starting a company.
Oh, no, I learned how to do the actual task of cutting film at a film laboratory. So I knew how to do it. And then my business partner and I, another woman, we saw the opportunity to exploit the new technology to provide a better service for the film industry generally, using this basic tech and solving a real problem, which was bringing the cost of post-production down. It seemed a very natural thing to me to look at a problem that needed solving and build a business out of it.
That's amazing. And as we will probably discuss like even in further, there seems to be like a tech pattern weaving through your career. So is technology something that you've always been really interested in, and that's kind of like why you focused on it?
Yeah, that's a good question. Not for its own sake, but for the way it changes the things it touches. That's what interests me, is the transformative effect. And all you need to do to learn how to wield it, if you like, is just look at it and try and look around the corners of it a little bit quicker than somebody else.
So after going through that period of working on a company, you also went to uni and got a communications degree.
Did a communications degree with a digital as well as television production major. So I wanted to take the technical knowledge that I had and understand a little bit better at the time. And then went straight into working in broadcast. So because of my background in film and television post-production, and then adding the degree, it was quite obvious to go work at the front end, if you like, of TV production. So I started working in the newsroom at TVNZ, and after a few months of producing, researching, whoever it was said to me, "Well, why don't you get on the front end and go on air?" And I was a bit taken aback because that wasn't even vaguely part of my aspiration. But I saw that I could learn faster, and I could control the story, and I could produce it myself as well as present it. So I took the challenge, and I had to have deportment and speaking training and getting my hair done. So it was a sort of baptism by fire to have been someone working behind the scenes quietly to suddenly being in a very public facing role, which I was for maybe 6 or 7 years through TVNZ, then across to TV3. And my areas of interest and the domains that I reported on were business and technology. And I mean, maybe that was for two reasons. One, because they were my areas of interest, because they seemed to be two places that could advance New Zealand's fortunes, if you like, outside of, dairy cows and trees, and I've always been slightly obsessed with our productivity. The other thing is I didn't like sport or crime, or so I gravitated to the areas where I thought that I could enjoy the domain as well as make a positive contribution. So that gave me the opportunity, if you like, to meet lots of leading New Zealanders and people from overseas, and I also reported, across Asia Pacific, and learnt a lot about business and business leaders and business leadership through that process, as well as trying to be on the front end of newer technologies, particularly related to broadcasting and communications. And around that time, which will seem like quite a long time ago now, YouTube, Facebook, social media platforms started to come in and again disintermediate the way that news was gathered and financed. Very heavy satellite links and could be replaced by someone tweeting. So suddenly the business models didn't hang together, and this was a technically driven change. I saw that and I started to think, well, what's next, frankly? I was reporting, or actually producing, the news coverage of the bombing situation. It was a tragic situation in Delhi. And there was someone trapped in a hotel that I was following on Twitter. And at the time, there were only about 320 New Zealanders on Twitter, which is now X at the time. And I managed to get in touch with this person. None of the big networks could get close to the action, and we couldn't get pictures. But this guy, I could put him on a live link, and he could look out the window and tell me what was going on.
Oh,
And
wow.
suddenly, news gathering had changed. And I saw that the existing business model, which has proven out, and I was obviously not the first to notice this, just didn't stack up anymore. And it's obviously been a painful process for the way that those institutions have been funded and revenue gathered and distributed their news content since that time. So I jumped out of that into something altogether else.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And during your time covering news and specifically in tech, what is it now, like maybe more than a decade ago, granted that the space and aerospace industry in New Zealand wasn't existing then, were there any indications during that time when you were covering tech that there will be a New Zealand space community that potentially will grow into an ecosystem that it is today?
Absolutely none.
I'm just like trying to figure out whether if there is even any indication from the past that it even
Well, I mean, one thing is that I was lucky enough to work an executive role at Datacom, but also at Callaghan Innovation. And where I like to think about the space ecosystem here is probably a little bit like Sir Paul Callaghan said, New Zealanders thrive by doing the weird things. And sometimes things are a combination of inspiring people with big ambition and the ability to execute on them, as well as a bit of good fortune. And New Zealand, as we know, cannot compete on anything at scale. So we do have to be clever in the way we look around for the corners, for the margins, for the new opportunities that can create value at scale where they don't exist. And I guess that brings me to Zeno, where I feel absolutely blessed to be operating at the moment.
Yeah, and in terms of again, you mentioned your work at Callaghan as well. During those times, how does the deep tech technologies, or that you can potentially even talk about, how do you see those technologies evolve and into the startups that exist today?
I think, I mean, there's a sort of well-worn path, right? The invention creativity occurs in research institutions, universities, and the brilliant minds of researchers. And those germs of ideas then grow or spin out of those institutions. And best practice is they become commercializable and are commercialized and grow into scale companies that employ people, advance the technology or the original thesis, and thrive. And what we do know that that doesn't happen with the frequency or volume that we hope or need to as a country. And I was fortunate in my role at Callaghan Innovation to have a few years trying to address that situation in terms of supporting allocation of funding and a number of other functions.
And do you think that those challenges that we had before, do they still exist today, or has it changed?
Not from what I can see. I mean, our share of, you know, GDP growth related to R&D expenditure is dropping, not increasing, unless I haven't seen the latest data. So we don't appear to be moving forward nationally in a way that we had hoped to, as far as I understood it. And it's not without effort. There are many people dedicated to this effort, and also, you know, companies striving to make a difference and build themselves offshore. But it doesn't appear, despite, you know, global communications advancing, it doesn't appear to have gotten much easier in the last 5 to 10 years.
And what do you think that is? Like, what are the challenges?
I can be honest here, or I can be polite, and I probably always prefer to be honest. I think one of our issues is culturally, we find the notion of sales slightly repellent. I've thrown myself into sales because people buy things from people, and sales is the conduit for growth, for solving problems, and for building value. And it's not a word we even use that often, whereas I'm unabashedly pro-sales. And it's not that you want to sell something to somebody that they don't want, because no one buys that. In the case of the space sector, you know, I'm with Zeno, and we have a capability as well as a product that solves problems that have been previously unsolvable. And therefore, the sales process is actually helpful in resolving issues for your customer. So I think that one of the ways that we could consider advancing nationally is to get over this past its use by date attitude that sales marketing is some kind of lipstick on the real business, and the real business being the science, the engineering. And I think there needs to be a happy marriage of both of those sets of capabilities in order to thrive.
I absolutely agree. And with the commercialization as well of the industry coming from, you know, purely government efforts, like before, you got to have all of the facets of a business, not just the tech, but also the business and the finance side of things.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because throughout my career, I've primarily been a business person. So, you know, nearly 15 years or so as an executive. And that means usually in New Zealand, you have to be multi-hatted and do a range of different things. My mission has always been around advancing a business and doing it by exploiting things that haven't been either done before, or connecting things together that become more efficient by being connected. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And a follow-up to that is that, yeah, also looking at your roles coming from more marketing and journalism, and then working for tech companies like Datacom and Soul Machines, it seems, and maybe you can expound, you transitioned from more of the communications and marketing side to the business and strategy and development side. And again, for the people in the audience who have the same sort of either experience and skill set, how does one transition over into a more business strategy and, you know, executive management roles like you have done?
I'm going to answer that a couple of ways. If I hadn't spent the first decade of my life running my own business, I don't think I would have had the desire or aptitude to do so. But In an executive role, you don't just swim in your lane. You do have to be multifaceted because there's always issues to resolve and opportunities to exploit, if you like, in a team. So one thing that I've found is that having complementary skills to the people around you makes your team stronger and means that you can exponentially punch above your weight of your individual sets of skills. You know, you don't just take six people, take their IQ, and add it together. There's a way that a team can start to operate like an organism that's healthy, that gives the business greater momentum, cultural growth, and change. But to answer your question more specifically, it's about impact. And I've always been interested in being in the place in the business that provides impact. And in a startup, that's revenue generation or sales.
Prior to Zeno, you worked at Soul Machines. What was the highlight for you there?
Oh, it is a stunning company and a really interesting role. A highlight for me was not long after I started, it coincided with the pandemic starting, COVID-19. A highlight for me was working in this humanized AI to be fortunate enough to have connected with the World Health Organization at the height of the pandemic. Well, actually, in the opening days, I think it was April 2020. And within 7 weeks, we had built a COVID-19 awareness raising digital person utilizing AI, speaking fluently on the pandemic and the risks associated with tobacco use at the time and COVID-19. And we called her Florence. She, well, the World Health Organization called her Florence. And she was like a global healthcare educator at a time when misinformation was rife and is more rife now. I'm incredibly proud. It was probably a career highlight being able to advance public healthcare using, you know, cutting-edge technology and produce a empathetic healthcare worker that could speak seven languages and provide fluent factual information on this, you know, pandemic in the early stages. That, alongside working globally in such a cutting-edge company, a deep tech startup from New Zealand, gave me massive opportunities to work directly with the world's leading businesses, you know, massive brands like Pfizer, Bank of America, you know, huge companies. It was an incredible learning experience and one that I feel privileged to have had.
That sounds really amazing. I mean, just imagining the impact that your work, Soul Machines, and the company itself is doing for basically globally. Sounds really fantastic.
So I also wanted to go back a little bit.
So after working for Callahan, why did you move from an executive role to a startup?
I love this question because I'm working for the government and was in a privileged position of supporting R&D funding, you know, tech accelerators and incubators, the R&D grants, and, you know, the wonderful sectors teams to support companies to grow and scale and invest in R&D and commercialize their science or their products or their ideas. And here's me bossing people around to do something that I hadn't actually done directly myself. And I started to think that I felt not a fraud, but I just thought, I really want to try this. And it was a fairly radical sideways move, I guess. I jumped out of a very comfortable big team executive role with all the things and that you have there into something that was really jumping into the unknown. It was this sort of sideways move that taught me the most in my career to date. It also gave me the courage and confidence to know that what I could offer a startup company that's scaling and commercializing deep science was going to be useful and, most of all, create impact.
Well, definitely, I think your leap of faith has certainly advanced and helped Zeno quite a bit this past year or so, especially with what has happened today. It's really amazing to see.
It's wonderful to be part of a dedicated team We're incredibly focused.
Yeah. Today, you are the chief revenue officer for Zeno. I guess following up on what you just mentioned, what does your role entail? What is a day in the life of Erica Lloyd at Zeno, and what excites you as part of that job?
My job is to generate revenue for Zeno, support the commercialization of the science and technology we have, so work with my colleagues and my boss to help transform the company into a product company. We are creating products, we have one in market, and advance that go-to-market, put our technology in the hands of scale customers. And for us, that is, innovative new space operators and some of these big commercial primes and government entities as well that can benefit from our technology. I believe I'm the only non-engineer at Zeno. So diversity in terms of my perspective and experience is really useful. And I'm blessed to be in a company that thrives on diversity and looking round corners, walking around problems and opportunities, truly innovating.
That's great, which is very important and often something that people just don't even think about. So they always think about the tech or the product.
I think what, and a nod to my boss, Max Ashewsky, is that he saw that a company that builds something beautiful but no one knows what it is or gets their hands on it is the company that will fail. A company that builds something beautiful and then puts that in the hands of the best minds and the best practitioners in the space sector on the planet is one that will thrive. So it's not complicated. It's not easy, but it's not complicated. Zeno, we have globally leading technology. It's our IP to use the force generated by superconducting magnets for a range of space applications, starting with attitude control, which is our first, beachhead product to market, is to put this in the hands of the engineers of the primes and the best new space operators in the market so they can accept the benefits and then take orders.
And so, yeah, I know we've kind of talked around Zeno itself during the interview, but also for, I guess, the benefit of the audience, can you give a little bit more introduction to Zeno and what it is doing today?
Zeno is New Zealand, but it's also US-based. We have a virtual office in the US as well as in Munich in Germany. And our company is the pioneer and the global leader of superconducting magnets for a range of space applications. What Zeno is doing is enabling fully autonomous and fuel-free satellite positioning and precision interactions between satellites as well. But that's just the beginning. Our first product is focused on pointing, if you like, on attitude control. But we're already having a lot of demand from the market for Zeno to start addressing a range of other problems that can be solved around positioning or in orbit, docking and formation flying, as well as radiation shielding to protect vulnerable human beings in the harsh environment of space, but also to protect vulnerable componentry. So potentially, if we're fast and clever enough, Zeno can create a magnetic field to enable satellite manufacturers to use off-the-shelf hardware and things like that. So there's a big range of things that we do. It's very varied, but the core technology is these superconducting magnets for space.
Maybe if you can expound as well on why is it revolutionary? Why is it, a cut above the rest of some of the other players in the same area today?
It's essentially a paradigm shift, if you like. So using superconducting magnets instead of the existing technology is a significant leap forward. So in terms of attitude control, the technology is fairly antiquated. It works, but it's clunky and it's heavy and it hasn't changed a lot in the last 40, 50 years. We've seen a lot of commercialization in the space sector, but not invention of something completely new. What Max has done is invented a way to utilize a high temperature superconducting magnet, cool enough to be effective to create torque force in the space context. And this can be applied to a number of different applications that solve pressing and immediate problems for satellite manufacturers and operators.
Yeah, I remember, so it's about, I think, 3 years ago now when I interviewed Max as well. And it's just so amazing to see how, you know, the product can be, you know, smaller than the normal actuators today. It's just, I think it's revolutionary in a way that it takes the form factor of, you know, how big or small your satellite gives it more opportunity for having a much smaller either spacecraft or satellite because of the form factor of what Zeno has created, which is really fantastic.
Correct. I mean, we see it as a technology that will empower a whole range of innovations and is not a flash in the pan. You know, this is a lasting change. And the way that I was struck around the impact of this technology is how Max describes it is currently everything in space is made by the Earth, is created on Earth, fueled by Earth-based fuels. And a superconducting magnet can act as a sort of anchor or a sail, harnessing the most unifying or dominant force there is existing, an unlimited supply, you know, which is magnetic fields.
Yep, it's fuel-free.
100% fuel-free and unlimited in terms of resource, unlimited in terms of no waste, and can lengthen the life of a spacecraft significantly, add significantly to its productivity, and sort of change the paradigm of it, the economics of it, in a way that we're still touching upon.
Yeah, it's super fantastic to actually see this come out of New Zealand. And as I understand, the Zeno got its first hardware also launched quite recently through, I guess, the orbit and SpaceX.
We put our tech demo in orbit on the SpaceX Falcon 9 at the beginning of December. And we're now enjoying seeing the results coming to us of this initial tech demo.
That's awesome. And what do you think is the significance of the milestone for Zeno as a company?
Number one, it was ahead of our predicted time. We've moved faster than we said we would. Two, qualify, if you like, to earn the space heritage based on our tech demo being in orbit, to reassure the market that what we're saying works in space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. You've got flight heritage basically as well now, which is pretty awesome for a startup. And so for the audience, where do you see Zeno in like 3 to 5 years, if you can actually talk about some of the initiatives that are coming up?
I probably won't talk in too much detail. I mean, we're a small team with ambition to take this technology to the primes, to the market, and we're having very favorable reception. So our business traction is incredibly positive. And I'm just back from a roadshow in the US and where we met with a good proportion of the top 10, you know, space aerospace companies in the world. And the reception was incredibly positive. And some wonder and wonderment at this concept having been proved out, that Zeno has been capable of solving a previously unsolvable issue, which is to get these things working at the right temperature in a space environment, that the innovation had been turned into a product that we could put in their hands. And it was a wonderful moment to see that for people who had been wondering where this technology was at, to see their surprise and delight, frankly, that it is as advanced as it is, that Zeno's taken it this far forward.
Yeah, it's just so fantastic. Yeah, I'm really thrilled for the company.
Another benefit too is because, you know, of the IP that we're generating, you know, other research institutions are able to start to create and ideate on our base platform, and other applications will be coming into market for the benefit of the wider sector, like plasma propulsion and other applications. So this is really pleasing too.
That's amazing. And so, like, in general, because Zeno is a New Zealand-based startup company. What do you think is the outlook of the New Zealand space ecosystem in New Zealand in general for space startups? Do you see that there will be an increase in space startups? Will they thrive? Are there still big challenges?
The way I look at it is there's two things. One is deep tech. Commercializing deep tech, which is what Zeno is doing, is never easy. Commercializing deep technology in space, harder still. And yet we're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
My view is that this company could be anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It happens to be here, and that makes it extra wonderful. We have tremendous engineers and thinkers and dreamers and doers in the team who work incredibly hard and are advancing the product on a daily basis. In terms of the wider space ecosystem here in New Zealand, we obviously have a debt of gratitude to Rocket Lab for sort of putting us on the map, a debt of gratitude to the New Zealand government for opening a sympathetic regulatory environment for the sector to be able to thrive. And being part of one of the world's friendly nations, if you like, being able to trade freely and operate with great degrees of freedom is also massively beneficial, as is now having a dedicated space minister. And we hope that that will help accelerate some of the fortunes of the community, if you like, as we go on. I can't make any predictions for the space sector here, but I can tell you, as a company and a small part of it, we're incredibly ambitious for what we can bring to market. We're ambitious for the outcomes and the positive impact we can make for the customers we work with, and the way that we can advance sort of space sector manufacturing for good. You know, a fuel-free magnetic solution has only got to do good in the world. And being part of that, to be fair, is a career highlight for me.
That's so awesome to hear. I just can't wait to see, like, in a few years' time, where all of this tech and ecosystem is going to be. So going back to personally your experience, you know, space is a daunting area to play in, and especially for women, and like in general for non-techies, which are coming from other disciplines, and because of this perceived bias that you need to be either a rocket scientist or an engineer. So I just wanted to ask you, what would you recommend to those who still are doubting that they can succeed in this space, no pun intended? And yeah, what would your recommendations be, or food for thought for the people in the audience?
I think be really clear on the areas you can add value. Be relentless in the way that you execute in the areas that you add value, and knowing that what I've talked about in terms of commercialization and sales, marketing are not just nice to have, but you need the self-esteem to know that they're essential, mm-hmm. and you need to fall into a culture that respects and acknowledges that as well. There are some cultures that don't, that they're technology first and everything else is silly. Whereas I'm lucky because it's really clear to my colleagues that, you know, for the tech to advance, it needs to be connected to humans who are on the other side of the world. And there's a few ways to do that. It would be wonderful to be all things to everybody, to be a rocket scientist as well as a marketeer and a salesperson, but that's unusual. Most people generally specialize, and I've specialized in, you know, human-to-human connections and working out how to solve problems, being relentlessly curious and always wanting to know how to maybe do it better, why this is the status quo, making things go faster, seeing how we can improve productivity and move more quickly. I've always been like that. Maybe it was because I had the first 10 years of my working life was running my own business, and you have to solve those things yourself. And frankly, it was a tech company that was doing something innovative. And the fact that it got disintermediated was a lifelong lesson to me in terms of walking obsolescence. You can't rest on your laurels. You know, remaining curious, staying up to date with what's actually happening, and ensuring that your skills are honed, your relationships are maintained, is really useful practice.
Wow. Yeah, thanks so much for those thoughts. And I guess my last questions are just any recommendations on resources or anything about anybody could potentially also take advantage of in terms of either the space industry or personal development.
The way I found it was you had to be brave enough, or I had to be brave enough to let go of seniority and comfort in one particular fairly narrow field in order to learn how to adapt and thrive to another. And that means letting go of things like big paychecks or status sometimes, teams, comfort, and trying something new. And for me, jumping into a startup after an exec job running a team of, I don't know, 120 people or something, to being just you with a cell phone on a plane was quite confronting, but also very exciting, because you have to fall onto your own resources and realize that you can do whatever it takes to solve the problem for a customer, provided you're thoughtful in the way you do it. You believe in the product you're selling. You respect the relationship. And it's a hell of a lot of hard work, relentless, process-driven hard work as well. You know, nothing comes easily to anybody. You don't just fall into success. You have to persist. Wow. And I guess that's not very exciting advice, but
no, but it's really very relevant and very important.
Yeah, I mean, everything's a trade-off, right? So if you want to try something new or work in a new domain, you have to lose something from your existing one, and be prepared to do it. You can't have both. But the benefits, and I've found, is that being able to bring large-scale global corporate skill to a smaller startup are really beneficial. Also, the amount that I've learned has been extraordinary. So your own learning journey is amplified by trying something different. Yeah, and please don't get me wrong. I'm sure that a degree in astrophysics or mechanical engineering
yes, of course.
is a sensible and incredibly creative pathway as well. I'm just fortunate as a business person to have clicked at the right time with the right company.
So true. So before we close, any parting or last words of advice for the audience?
You know, get your degree, obviously study and learn continuously. Being an engineer is immensely useful. It's a wonderful thing to do. But in terms of aspiring to be in a sector like this, show no fear. Leap into the unknown and know that what you have or can bring value. You do have to work hard, but the rewards are there. It is a fascinating sector. And it's funny to say over the moon, but I feel over the moon to be part of it as it scales.
Thank you so much, Erica, for sharing your experiences and insights, especially to the New Zealand community and the next generation of potential young space, sort of like cadets out there who are like really interested in participating in the industry. Thanks again for your time today. And thank you everyone for listening. If you like Spacebase's work and would like to support us, please check us out on spacebase.co. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.